Now I can't do it. Once more. Okay. CKUT 90.3 FM.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Wait, do you want me to say hello?
I'll have to do another one.
Yeah, maybe one last one.
Radio CKUT 90.3 FM.
Are you recording? You are? Oh.
Good morning and welcome to the December 16th edition of Dromotext. Tonight on the show we have another presentation from the Hammer Museum Poetry Series down in Los Angeles. This one is the poems of Robin Robinson. And, it lasts about an hour, and so we'll get to it right now. Here he is.
I'm Stephen Yenzer in the English department at UCLA. They're one of the sponsors, of course, of the readings. As is the Friends of English, and obviously the Hammer Museum and Cultural and Recreational Affairs at UCLA. Please turn off any noise-making gizmos that you have. And if you are not on my mailing list, that is to say the English Department's mailing list, if you will see me after the reading, I will get you there, then you'll be on yet another mailing list. And you'll never, never miss a poetry reading. So, I was thinking yesterday about Robin Robertson's visit, and I was reading again in Sailing the Forest, his new selected poems, and Hill of Doors, his most recent full volume, and Bacchae, his just-published translation of Euripides' play. Mr. Robertson is prolific, and more to the point, no more to our point, he's exceptionally accomplished, as all the awards he's earned in England and Scotland truthfully attest. Anyway, there I was in my study in my comfy desk chair, surrounded by his recent oeuvre, when my new London Review of Books slipped through the mail slot. So I left my desk for a minute to see what was new in Transatlantic Fare, and discovered there in the London Review a longish, quite impressive, uncanny poem entitled Beside Lough Ifrin by, of course, Robin Robertson. I hope that he will read it tonight, though I pressed it upon him at the last minute, and I'm not sure that he's going to do so. But in any event, I'm going to characterize it in part because it seems to me to embody some of the strengths that run through his work. The poem is, for one thing, deeply rooted in the local loam. The landscape is rural, immediate, featuring particular flora and fauna, and the diction is, I use the word advisedly, homely, though at the same time exotic to my ear, and I suspect to many a British ear, if to a lesser extent, because the words are often old words, and sometimes fossils, even as they are plain and hard as the elements they describe. It's scythe and sickle, words that appear in the poem, are of course still with us, though we can foresee their obsolescence as the implements themselves rust out in sheds and barns and turn up at antique sales across the country. But scale, S-K-A-I-L, and scudder are rare, while fetch and libbed and raved, R-E-I-V-E-D, are words of the sort that will send American graduate students to the OED right away. It's a delight in its freshness, its fusty freshness, one might say, this ripe, archaic language. And while its meanings might be uncertain at first, to many of us, I don't think it feels foreign. It smells and tastes fundamentally Anglo, with overtones of Scots and Gaelic. So, too, the proverbs and folklore integral to the poem are familiar, intimate, at the same time that they seem newly minted. We might never have heard, for instance, a woman's curse will grave you to hell, but we know what it means in our morrow. And if we are startled to read about a fox with a firebrand tied to its tail, wreaking havoc through the countryside, we dimly recall something we've heard so long ago that, well, it must be basic, maybe even biblical. We won't understand a certain Scots term that I won't try to pronounce, but when we infer that it refers to a clay doll busied with pins, in his phrase, I love busied with pins, we recognize a cousin of the voodoo doll, and thus a tie to a world omnipresent but often ignored, a world dominated by the primitive, the irrational. We associate it perhaps with the Dionysian, and we find it again, of course, in Bacchae, as well as in Mr. Robertson's other poems and his versions of Nanus and Ovid. It's a world the Greeks knew well, of course, Apollo notwithstanding. Those of you who heard Alice Oswald read her memorial here a few weeks ago might recognize a relationship. But it's a realm, magical, demonic, elemental by turns, that we don't often encounter these days in American poetry, alas. There's much else going on in the poems you will hear this evening, but it's interesting to muse with all on the possibility that American poets might learn or relearn something about nature in its rawness, its richness, and its depth from the other civilized side of the Atlantic. Robin Robertson.
This is where I'm from. Aberdeen. The grey sea turns in its sleep, disturbing seagulls from the green rock. We watched the long collapse, the black drop and frothing of the toppled wave, looked out on the dark that goes to Norway. We lay all night in an open boat that rocked by the harbor wall, listening to the tires creak at the stone quay, trying to keep time till the night fishers came in their arc, their lap of light, the fat slap of waves, the waters sway, the water mullioned with light. The sifting rain, italic rain, the smur that drifted down for days, the sleet, your hair full of hail as if sown there. In the damp sheets we left each other sea gifts, watermarks, long lost now in all these years of the riptide swell and trawl. All night, the feeding storm banked up the streets and houses. In the morning, the sky was yellow, the frost ringing. The grey sea turns in its sleep, disturbing seagulls from the green rock. I've been enjoying your American autumn in various places this past week, though New England's idea of it is very different from yours. So I thought I'd read a translation of a very early poem by Rilke called Herbst, which translates directly as autumn, although I've called it fall. I knew that he'd written it very soon after he arrived in Paris in 1902, but it was only much later when I was asked to do a bit of research on the genesis of the poem, long after it was published, long after the towers had fallen in New York, that I discovered that Rilke wrote this on the 11th of September. Fall. The leaves are falling, falling from trees in dying gardens far above us, as if their slow free fall was the sky declining. And tonight, this heavy earth is falling away from all the other stars, drawing into silence. We are all falling now. My hand, my heart, stall and drift in darkness, seesawing down. And we still believe there is one who sifts and holds the leaves, the lives of all those softly falling. Over the past wee while, I've been writing invented Scots narratives, folk narratives, which have something in common with the Celtic folk tradition. That is to say, they're everyday stories of murder, rape, madness, congenital malformation, and selkies, seals that turn themselves into humans and humans that turn themselves into seals. By Clachan Bridge. I remember the girl with the hair lip down by Clachan Bridge, cutting up fish to see how they worked. By morning's end, her nails were black red, her hands all sequined silver. She unpuzzled rabbits to a rickle of bones, dipped into a dormouse for the pip of its heart. She'd open everything, that girl. They say they found wax dolls in her wall, puppets full of human hair, but I'd say they're wrong. What's true is that the blacksmith's son, the simpleton, came down here once and fathomed her, claimed she licked him clean as a whistle. I remember the tiny stars of her hands around her belly as it grew and grew, and how, after a year, nothing came. How she said it was still there, inside her, a stone baby. And how I saw her wrists bangled with scars and those hands flittering at her throat to the plectrum of bone she'd hung there. As to what happened to the blacksmith's boy, no one knows, and I'll keep my tongue. Last thing I heard, the starlings had started to mimic her crying. And she'd found how to fly. Throughout the years, I've noticed that my readings involve two clear thematic sections, the carnality and mortality. And it's a great disappointment to me that the carnality section has shrunk over the years and the mortality has increased, almost overwhelming the former. But as this is a selected poem, I can draw on past experience. This is for anyone who feels peckish. Artichoke. The nubbed leaves come away in a tease of green, thinning down to the membrane, the quick purpled beginnings of the male. Then the slow hairs of the heart, the choke that guards its trophy, its vegetable goblet. The meat of it lies displayed, upended, al dente, the stub root aching in its oil. And similar theme. For reasons I didn't understand at the time and I still fail to grasp now, I was commissioned to write a poem about locksmiths. So I dutifully went and researched locksmithery and I found out various things, but it didn't quite hold my interest enough to write a poem. Although there was this, yes, there was interest. Then I thought, well, hang on, a poem is a bit like a lock in some ways. This kind of secret engine that can be opened. But that didn't work either. So I ended up writing what I wanted to write all along, although there are elements of the research that you might notice have resisted erosion. Wedding the locksmith's daughter. The slow-grained slide to embed the blade of the key is a sheathing, a gliding on graphite, pushing inside to find the ribs of the lock. Sunk home, the true key slots to its matrix, geared, tight-fitting, they turn together, shooting the spring lock, throwing the bolt. Dactyls, iambics, the clinch of words, the hidden couplings in the cased machine, a chime of sound on sound, the way the sung note snibs on meaning and holds. The lines engage and marry now, the bells are keeping time, the church doors close and open underground. Well, that's all very well, but in the end, all you get is a room and torrential rain. Exposure. Rain, you said, is silence turned up high. It has been raining now for days. Even when it stops, there is still the sound of rainwater laboring to find some way into the ground. We lie in grim embrace, these two halves trying to be whole, straining for this break in the static, in the white noise that was rain falling all day and all through the sheeted night. Silence is rain with the sound turned down, and I stare out now on a clear view of something left out on the line. A life snagged there, drenched, shrunken, unrecognizably mine. And if it's not rain, it's snow. This is a poem set on the first day of a new year in my part of the world. After a heavy snow. The park drunk. He opens his eyes to a hard frost, the morning's soft amnesia of snow. The thorned stems of gorse are starred crystal, each bud like a candied fruit, its yellow picked out and lit by the low pulse of blood orange riding in the eastern trees. What the snow has furred to silence, uniformity, frost amplifies, makes singular, giving every form a sound, an edge, as if frost wants to know what snow tries to forget. And so he drinks for winter, for the coming year, to open all the beautiful tiny doors in their crackleur of frost. And he drinks like the snow falling, trying to close the biggest door of all. That wasn't autobiographical, I hasten to add. The next two unusually are. This is still the mortality section, okay, just so you know. This is about my father. Ghost of a garden. Sometimes I discover I have gone downstairs, crossed the grass, and found myself in here. The tool shed, caught in a lash of brambles, bindweed, and tall ivied trees like pipe cleaners. It looks out vacantly on a garden run to seed, the lost tennis court grown over benches, a sunken barbecue snagged with blown roses. The courtyard walls are full of holes the swallows try to sew in and out of them like open doors. In the corner of the shed, my father is weeping, and I cannot help him because he is dead. And this poem is about the loss of a daughter, not happily a death, just the moment when a father knows when a child is somehow no longer a child. It's set on a beach on the west of Ireland at the end of the summer. Donegal for Ellie. Ardent on the beach at Rasnala on the last day of summer, you ran through the shallows, throwing off shoes and shirt and towel like the seasons, the city's years, all caught in my arms as I ploughed on behind you, guardian still of dry clothes, of this little heart, not quite 13, breasting the waves and calling back to me to join you, swimming in the Atlantic on the last day of summer. I saw a man in the shallows with his hands full of clothes, full of all the years, and his daughter going where he knew he could not follow. Many years ago, I had an operation to correct a congenital heart murmur. This involved powerful anesthesia and 4 hours of surgery to implant a mechanical aortic valve. I just thought you'd like to know all this. Otherwise, you won't understand the poem. Quite apart from all that indignity, the blood is circulating outside of the body for some considerable time, and it has been discovered that this can cause, in some cases, a kind of psychological disassociation, an emotional derangement, which explains everything. Okay. Anyway, this is a slightly forensic poem called The Halving. General anesthesia, a median sternotomy achieved by sternal saw. The ribs held aghast by retractor, the tubes and cannulae drawing the blood to the reservoir and its bubbler. The struggling aorta cross-clamped, the heart chilled and stopped and left to dry. The incompetent bicuspid valve excised. The new one, a carbon-coated disc housed expensively in a cage of tantalum, is broken from its sterile pouch, then heavily implanted into the native heart. Bolstered, seated with sutures. The aorta freed, the heart restarted. The blood allowed back after its time abroad, circulating in the machine, the rib spreader relaxed and the plumbing removed, the breastbone lashed with sternal wires, the incision closed. 4 hours I'd been away, out of my body, made to die, then jerked back to the world. The distractions of delirium came and went, and then, as the morphine drained, I was left with a split chest that ground and grated on itself. Over the pain, a blackness rose and swelled. Pump head is what some call it. Debris from the bypass machine migrating to the brain, but it felt more interesting than that. Halved and unhelmed, I have been away, I said to the ceiling. And now I am not myself. Of course, like everything else, heart surgery has its funny side. And some time after the operation, in the middle of the night, the 6-inch wound in my chest opened up. And this was disappointing on many levels. Mostly because it was a Saturday night and I was living in South London in Brixton, where the closest casualty department was famous then and now as a kind of war zone where you wouldn't be seen if you didn't have something like an axe in your head. A and E. It was like wetting the bed, waking up that night, soaked through, my sutures open again and the chest wound hemorrhaging. Pulling on jeans and an overcoat, I called a car to Camberwell and in through the shivering rubber doors presented myself at that Saturday night abattoir of casualty at King's on Denmark Hill. At this front line, behind her desk and barred window, the triage nurse was already waving me away till I parted the tweed to show her what I had going on underneath. Unfashionable, but striking nonetheless. My chest undone like some rare waistcoat, with that lace-up front, a black shell, its red wet look, leatherette, those fancy flapping lapels. This is a mortality section that keeps on giving. And you thought that A poem about a cat would just be a poem about a cat. But this cat, being one of my cats, has cancer. And I was just fascinated watching this poor animal. It wasn't mine, it was somebody else's, but anyway, get a poem out of anything. Cat failing. A figment, a thumbed maquette of a cat. Some ditched plaything, something brought in from outside. His white fur, stiff and grey, coming apart at the seams. I study the muzzle of perished rubber, one ear eaten away, his sour body lumped like a beanbag leaking thinly into a grim towel. I sit and watch the light degrade in his eyes. He tries and fails to climb to his chair, shirks in one corner of the kitchen, cowed, denatured, ceasing to be anything like a cat. And there's a new look in those eyes that refuse to meet mine, and it's the shame of being found out. Just that. And with that loss of face, his face, I see, has turned human. Few figures in Greek mythology have had more violence done to them for a simple mistake than Actaeon. Actaeon the hunter took a break from chasing deer with his dogs and went looking in the midday sun for some cool water, only to stumble across the goddess Artemis bathing naked in a pool. His punishment for disturbing the goddess was to be turned into a deer and pursued by his own hounds and torn apart. In this very, very short poem, which sort of poses as a translation but isn't, I imagine the dead Actaeon addressing his mother. You are sleeping, mother, and do not know my fate. I wish you could wake and embrace me, much changed as I am, with the horns and the hair of a stag, and only the eyes and voice the same as Actaeon. My dogs did what I trained them to do. Forgive them. If you see my lost bow, break it. Bury it with my bones. I know you found no sign of them in the woods, but look again. Look for a freckled coat and not a tunic. Branched antlers, not smooth temples. And longer legs than you remember, that end not in feet, but in hooves. So I was in Harvard earlier on in all of this, and my old pal James Wood asked me where I was going, and I said I was, amongst other places, I was coming here. I said, well, you know, they won't understand a word you're saying. You know, all your poems are about snow and rain and ice. And so I decided with Stephen's help that I could at least bring something to you in your red flag situation. You've had a drought. We didn't have much of a winter in Britain. We didn't have any winter, really, and I think this was the prompt for this poem, which is the one Stephen was mentioning that's just come out. And so it has various words which you're just going to have to look up. But there's one that's quite important, the a reaved man. To reave is to steal. The border reavers in Scotland would come down and rustle sheep and cattle. And the word bereave is from that root, to have something stolen from you. This is it's called Beside. It's another one of these Scots narratives I keep making up. Beside Loch Ithrin. Late January and the oak still green, the year already wrong. The season miscarried, the lambs in the field and the blossom blown, the whole year broken before it began, and me standing where winter should have been, a reaved man, a man forspoken. A woman's kiss will lift you all morning, a woman's curse will grave you to hell. By the wellspring on the high moor, I saw the day change colour, watched lightning root in the far woods, the sky blink, fire shocks, then a scour of rain, a scale wind nagging in through the murk, scuddering, dishing it down, rain turning to sleet, to hail, to snow, and then the cold, which had been waiting, dropped. The green heath silvered, every leaf singled out like rosemary. The well went milky as a dead eye, smoked with ice, though I caught sight of something as the surface froze, a clay doll, a corp creach, busied with pins, and I started down for home, where far below I saw the loch water growing from grey to white, its long fetch shaved by draw knife, scythe and sickle into ice, with the whipped spray turning hard in the air and splintering on the shore. The next day, the ice so thick, we cut holes in it so the fish could breathe, and we gathered round to watch them, the trout rising, crowding tight up into a gasp of mouths, silver and pink, these bright sheaves alive there in the ice. Then the cold went down too deep, and the fish were locked like till in the glass. Birds fell stiff from the sky. Every lamb died. The cows that were left gave more blood than milk. They found young Neil MacLean, the stammerer, roped to a tree, libbed, with his tongue shelled out of his head, dressed in red icicles. Betty Campbell frozen solid in her bath, forehead scored with the cross. I saw Macaulay's mare with the bleed on the brain going round her field faster and faster till she bolted straight into the stable wall. I saw a fox with a firebrand tied to its tail going over the high cliff, bundled in flames. And off to the west, a funeral procession on the side of a hill where no road lay. 3 months under winter, until winter broke. They tested the loch with their toes, the blister of air squeezed white under the ice, wobbling back like a spirit leveling. It took their weight for a while, till the loch creaked and a mile-long crack appeared, and they couldn't tell what was ice and what was shore, watching their footprints soften, sink, dissolve, their hard and perfect world falling to thaw. A woman's kiss will lift you all morning. A woman's curse will grave you to hell. The thing in the wellspring is gone, the clay worn away to a bed of pins. I am taken. I am not right, only barely in the likeness of a man, walking from Lochifrin in a pang of birdsong, carrying myself on a hill where no road lies. There's almost no difference between the mortality section and the rest of it, I notice. I'm sure you're all familiar with bothies and sheelings, which are those small huts that you find on mountains where climbers and hikers can take shelter during bad weather. I've always found these places absolutely terrifying, and so this poem is about one of those places. It's a kind of extended unheimlich maneuver. The shelter. I should never have stayed here in this cold sheeling once the storm passed and the rain had finally eased. I could make out shapes inside, the occasional sound, a muffled crying which I took for wind in the trees, a wasp stuttering there at the windowsill. I listened. What looked like a small red coat was dripping from its wire hanger. There was a shift and rustle coming from the bucket in the corner by the door. I found inside a crumpled fist of balled up paper slowly uncrinkling. On the hearth, just legible in the warm ash, my name and dates. And above that, in a shard of mirror left in the frame, I caught sight of myself wearing something like a black brooch at the neck. Then I looked more closely, and I saw what it was. New York is mad for Halloween, which is very alarming, given that it's a Celtic festival that's got nothing to do with any of the nonsense that of pumpkins and trick-or-treating. The only thing we ever did was set fire to each other. But in the spirit of special relationships, I'm going to read a ghost story. This is not really a poem. This is just a little story I cooked up. The Dream House. For 10 years, I dreamt of the same house, until I knew every corridor and cornice, the grain of the wood in every board, the way light fell in different rooms at different times of day. Its lines and angles grew more perfect, dream by dream. This summer, walking in woods near a town I'd never been before, I came to this familiar gate, and beyond that saw a path I recognized, and there it was, with a sign for sale, among larch and pine and sycamore. The Dream House. I rang the bell, and when the owner came, I asked him if he'd think it very strange if I showed him round. To the left, I explained, is the lounge and panelled library. To the right, the long dining room with the kitchen beyond. As we went upstairs to the four bedrooms with their broad bay windows and the blue drapes, I was stopped dead on the landing by a small red door I'd never seen before. It was new, he said, and just put in that day. Downstairs, I asked him what he wanted for the house. He named a price so low, I think I showed my surprise, but said I'd take it. Then he told me why it was cheap, because it was haunted, but said I shouldn't mind. It would be fine for me, since I was the ghost. That was a month ago, and now I have the keys. I explore, knowing each room like my own body, until I remember the tiny red door. The keys are all too big, except for one the size of a sparrow's claw. I kneel down and open the lock, and there, in the darkness, is a miniature house. Through the windows, in behind the walls, I see my son is safe indoors. How little he's grown. Look at him. The boy I dreamt had died 10 years before. So before the grim Scottish finale, I will read a handful of love poems. This is a sonnet, which is sort of about chasing the last of the day's sun. A love poem that's trying to stay out of the shadows. Abandon. That moment when the sun ignites the valley and picks out every bud that's greened that afternoon, when birds spill from the trees like shaken sheets, that sudden loosening into beauty, the want in her eyes fleet blue, the medals of light on water, the way the water intrigued about her feet, the ocean walking her out into its depth, sea lighting the length of her from the narrow waist to the weight of the breasts. The way she lifted her eyes to me and handed me back, simplified. That moment at the end, knowing the one I had abandoned was myself, edging with the sun around the bay's scoop of rocks, rolling the last gold round the glass. That shelving love as the sun was lost to us and the sky bruised and the stones grew cold as the shells on the beach at Naxos. Appropriately in a museum or art gallery, this is a poem about a painting, another sonnet And this is a poem prompted by one of Chardin's marvelous still lifes. Glass of water and coffee pot. And the painting, I'm sure you all know it, has indeed a glass of water and a coffee pot, brown coffee pot, and some heads of garlic. Glass of water and coffee pot. And this is sort of partly about the painting and partly about where I live now, in London. These rooms of wood, of tongue and groove, open out on a garden of whitewashed walls and a maple tree, a new spring bright among the weathered stone and brick. We find things that are old and used, well made, well worn, and beautiful because of this. The balance intimate between that glass of water's clarity and light and the pot's grave darkness. An order so luminous and fine you needn't measure it with a rule. Just look. The papery whiteness of the garlic heads is the same light held in the water glass, the same light lifting a gleam from the blackened coffee pot that's somehow managed to make it through, to find harmony here on this stone shelf, happiness of the hand and heart, to keep its heat and still pour clean and true. And the happier they get, the shorter they get, I discover. This is an 8-line poem which takes its title from a small harbour village in Islay, in the Inner Hebrides of Scotland. Portnahavan. We walked the cliff of Portnahavan, listening to the grey seals sing on Orsay and Eileen McConnach across the little harbour. Were they singing for the love of being here in this place, like us, far from griefs? And were they also singing, as we were, to each other? And then the most cheerful poem I've ever written is barely, well, it's that, you know, that's what it is. The key, the door to the walled garden, the place I'd never been, was opened with a simple turn of the key I'd carried with me all these years. I'd like to thank Mona Simpson for bringing me here, and Stephen Yenser for his overgenerous introduction, and bringing that Loch Ifrin poem. Ifrin, by the way, means hell in Gaelic. So you know where you are. It would be quite wrong of me to leave you on such a buoyant, upbeat note. So this is another one of these invented Scots narratives to finish with. This is called A Drone Head. Thank you very much for coming. You'd know her house by the drawn blinds, by the cormorants pitched on the boundary wall, the black crosses of their wings hung out to dry. You'd tell it by the quicken and the pine that hid it from the sea and from the brief light of the sun, and by Angus the collie lying at the door where he died, a rack of bones like a sprung trap. A fork of barnacle geese came over with that slow squeak of rusty saws, the bitter seas complaining pool and roll, a whicker of pigeons lifting in the wood. She'd had 4 sons, I knew that well enough, and each one wrong. All born blind, they say, slack-jawed and simple, web-footed, rickety as sticks. Beautiful faces, I'm told, though, blank as air. Someone saw them once outside, hurtling down to the shore, chittering like rats, and said they were fine swimmers. But I would have guessed at that. Her husband left her, said they couldn't be his, they were more fish than human, said they were beglamoured, and searched their skin for the showing marks. For years, she tended each difficult flame, their tight, flickering bodies. Each night she closed the scales of their eyes to smoor the fire. Until he came again, that last time, thick with drink, saying he'd had enough of this, all this witchery, and made them stand in a row by their beds, twitching. Their hands flapped, herring eyes rolled in their heads. He went along the line, relaxing them one after another with a small knife. It said she goes out every night to lay blankets on the graves to keep them warm. It would put the heart across you, all that grief. There was an otter worrying in the leaves, a heron loping slow over the water when I came at scrake of day back to her door. She'd hung 4 stones in a necklace, wore 4 rings on the hand that led me past the room with 4 small candles burning, which she called the Room of Rain. Milky smoke poured up from the grate like a waterfall in reverse, and she said my name, and it was the last thing and the only thing she said. She gave me a skylark's egg in a bed of frost, gave me twists of my 4 sons' hair, gave me her husband's head in a wooden box. Then she gave me the seal skin, and I put it on. Thank you.
So that concludes this week's edition of Drama Text. We'll be back next week with another hour-long presentation on the spoken word.
I'm Martin Carly, and I like to popularize science. Vaccination against COVID-19 for children aged 5 to 11 has begun. As parents, you may be asking if your child will receive the same vaccine as adults. The vaccine used for children younger than 12 years old contains a smaller amount of mRNA because children's immune systems respond better than those of adults. And even though they're given smaller doses, the vaccine is just as effective.
For more information, visit quebec.ca/youthvaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Manisha.
Open the door. Seek new world. in here. CKUT 90.3 FM from Montreal.
I slept too little and drank too much. Anyway, get out of bed like this. Oh, Christ.
Rise and shine with CKUT 90.3 FM.